And welcome, friends, to the Generations Broadcast. Kevin Swanson, your host, with you today as we talk about worldview issues on this program. We're talking truth. We're talking relationships, bringing truth and relationships back to a lost and lonely world. And friends, today we want to talk about the nature of truth. We want to talk about apologetics. We want to talk about some of the most important discussions that you could possibly have as we try to develop an argument for the existence of God. Or do we have to do that? And as we establish an argument for the existence of God, must we first fear God as the beginning of all wisdom, including all defenses concerning the existence of God? Well, these are the questions we want to address today as we bring Dr. Jason Lyle back onto the radio program. If some of you may remember, we've interviewed him in the past. He's from Answers in Genesis. He's an astrophysicist who has done some wonderful things. Now he has a number of books out in relation to apologetics, including Ultimate Proof of Creation and Discerning Truth. Dr. Jason Lyle, welcome back to the program, my friend.
Well, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
You know, Jason, when you begin to talk about apologetics and you get involved in the discussions concerning creation and all these other things, we have to understand that these are not simple discussions necessarily. I mean, there's a sense in which it's a simple thing to fear God first and then go figure out the universe. But when you get into the discussions and the debates, it is a dog-eat-dog world out there, and it's important not to be wearing milk-bone pajamas and to be properly equipped in the debate. And I think that's what you're after with these books.
Well, that's right. I mean, God has told us that we need to be ready to give an answer when anyone asks a hope for the hope of the reason that's in us, the reason for the hope that's in us, pardon me. And we need to be ready to do that. And so that implies that we need to study a little bit. And I don't think it's tremendously hard to defend the faith, but it is going to take a little bit of study. It's going to take a little bit of practice. Hmm.
And one of the things I like about your books is they are fairly easy to follow. Not in the sense that you're addressing easy, simple issues, but you're able to step us through some of these things so we can examine the arguments and take a look at the evidence and hopefully begin to understand how the nature of evidence, epistemology, presuppositions, worldview analyses come into play as we begin to address these discussions. And so you've got to, I suppose, define some of these things for our audience. Why don't you do that first? Talk to us concerning worldviews and presuppositions. What is that?
Your worldview is basically your way of thinking about things. And we all have one. We all have a way of thinking about things. We all have some beliefs about how the universe works. I know people would like to think that we all come to the evidence with a clean slate, we don't have any previous conceptions and so on, but that just isn't the case. Everybody has presuppositions, which are those things that you believe before you investigate the evidence. For example, if there was a rock on the side of the road, and I said, boy, I'd like to do an experiment on that rock, find out what it's made of, do some chemistry and things like that, you'd think, well, I'm being pretty neutral, pretty objective, but I really am not, because I already have assumed that my senses are basically reliable. I've assumed the rock is there just because I see it. And so that already has, I've already made some assumptions about the universe. I've assumed that my eyes, what I see corresponds to reality. Mm-hmm. And very few people would not assume that. You wouldn't have too many people walk along and, well, there's a nice rock there, but it probably isn't there just because I see it. You know, it's probably just a hologram. Most people would assume that what they see and taste and touch and smell and feel and so on is real. Mm-hmm. And as a Christian, I can make sense of that. See, that's the thing I want to point out in my book, is that the Christian worldview can make sense of those things, those presuppositions that people take for granted, the things that make a rational worldview possible.
Hmm. I did a presentation on mathematics at the last homeschool conference in Denver, and I talked about the fact that unbelievers and believers both count. It's just that unbelievers have a hard time accounting for counting.
That's right. That's how Van Til liked to put it, and I agree with him completely.
So worldviews are important. Does every unbeliever acknowledge that he has a worldview?
Most of them aren't aware of their own.
Really?
The way I like to put it is worldviews are a little bit like kidneys.
Okay.
Everybody's got them, but not everybody realizes they have them.
Okay. Okay. And so you have to inform them. You have to say, hey, what's your worldview? They say, I don't even know I have a worldview. Then you begin to ask some basic questions about reality, about truth, about their understanding of ethics. And after a while, I think you can begin to get your hands around what their worldview is, maybe even tell them what their worldview is if they don't know what it is.
Yeah. In fact, the funny thing is a lot of times when they say they don't have a worldview, they then follow up with what their worldview is. They'll say, I don't have a worldview. I think we ought to be neutral in our interpretation of evidence. They say, oh, that's an interesting worldview. That is their philosophy, you see.
Right. Their very next statement will help you understand something of their worldview. And so the worldview really plays into evidence. How does it play into the evidence?
Well, basically, anytime we draw any conclusions about anything from any evidence, our worldview comes into play. There's no doubt about that. When we see a magician do a magic trick, most adults would say, well, you know, he didn't really saw that woman in half and put her back together. Now, my senses say that he did, but I know because I have presuppositions that people can't be sawed in half and live and so on. I have presuppositions that tell me that there's some kind of trick involved. Maybe I don't understand all the details, but my presuppositions inform my understanding of the evidence that I see. A child does not have necessarily the proper presuppositions, and so a child might be dumbfounded and say, wow, that magician really did saw that person in half.
Yeah.
So it's not that presuppositions are bad, but we all have them. They can be very helpful. They can help you to draw the right conclusion from the evidence if you have the right presuppositions.
Mm.
And so that's what we really need to think through, is how do we know that our presuppositions are right? And that's what the book, The Ultimate Proof of Creation, is really talking about. It shows that only biblical presuppositions will ultimately make knowledge possible. So if you're going to have, if you're going to know anything about anything, you've got to have biblical presuppositions.
Jason, take the family that bought the old house in Salem, Massachusetts. That's 300 years old. And the guy's laying awake at night and hears creaking in the floors. He begins to interpret the evidence, doesn't he?
That's right. And of course, your worldview will have a drastic effect on how you interpret that evidence. Now, I have a supernatural worldview, but at the same time, I don't believe in ghosts of the kind that some people believe in today.
Mm.
And so I'm immediately going to reject certain things that other
right.
people might accept. They might say, well, it's aliens, or it's ghosts, or whatever. I'm going to say, well, no, I know something about physics, and it's the heat of the building and whatnot. And so our worldview is going to affect our interpretation of that evidence.
Mm.
Very, very good point. So as we approach the quote-unquote evidence out there for evolution, and you know, the people are doing that. They're pulling a rock. They're taking radioactive decay rates out of that rock in AD 2011. They're drawing conclusions. How does that work?
Well, basically, with radiometric dating, there are certain assumptions that they've made regarding the constancy of rates and regarding the initial conditions. See, I can take a look at that same evidence, and I can say, well, I don't necessarily have the same assumptions that you do, and so I don't draw the same conclusion. And, of course, it's well known. We can take one of the ways that you can show that unbelieving presuppositions are false is to apply them consistently. And so, for example, with radiometric dating, we can take rocks from a recent volcano, say from Mount St. Helens, and we've done this, and we've had them and sent them in and had them radiometrically dated to find out their estimated age. Well, why would you do that? We already know their age. We know their age is less than a year old or less than a few years old.
Yeah.
Well, to check the method.
Okay.
And by applying secular techniques, we found that those rocks are allegedly hundreds of thousands of years old to millions of years old on rocks that we know are just a few years old.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you do is you show that the secular presuppositions on their own terms lead to an inconsistency, and that's called internal critique, and that's something that I really wish Christians would learn to do, because it's a very effective way of defending the Christian faith by showing that the alternatives are self-refuting.
Now, there are multiple layers of presuppositions that work all the time. The idea that radioactive dating method is accurate, they're assuming that their measurement devices are accurate. I mean, these are presuppositions. But then you start talking about uniformitarianism and such, and that's sort of a deeper level presupposition. And then they got a presupposition ultimately that, hey, that world is 4 billion years old and God's a non-factor. And that becomes more of a commitment as well. It seems like as you go deeper into their presuppositional framework, you can get into the more basic presuppositions and they become more stubborn, so to speak.
And you will find that the unbelievers, too, will inconsistently borrow Christian presuppositions without acknowledging the God that makes those presuppositions possible. See, theoretically, you'd think, well, the unbeliever ought to have opposite presuppositions to mine because I have a biblical worldview, and my unbelieving friend says, no, the Bible's wrong. We disagree on the most basic truth imaginable. You'd think we wouldn't agree on anything.
Yeah.
But because the unbeliever is also made in the image of God, he also knows in his heart of hearts the biblical God, and he's got those biblical presuppositions wired into him. Let me give you an example of this. Morality. Everybody knows that certain things are right and wrong.
Yes.
But how would that even make sense in an evolutionary universe? If we're just bags of chemicals, what one chemical does to another is morally irrelevant.
Mm.
When the baking soda interacts with the vinegar and it fizzes up and everything, you don't get angry at the baking soda and say, you shouldn't have interacted with that vinegar in that way. It doesn't have a choice. Chemicals do what chemicals do. And so if people are just chemicals, well, we don't really have any choice, and it wouldn't make sense to get angry at one person for example, shooting another, because it's just one chemical accident scrambling another chemical accident.
Sure.
But in the Christian worldview, oh, now it makes sense, because there's a God who's made us. He's made us in his image, and so we're responsible to God for our actions, and he will hold us accountable for our actions. And so I have a very good reason to behave in a particular way. Now, even unbelievers know that, but you see, on their own worldview, they shouldn't believe that. And so that's an example of a behavioral inconsistency. Their behavior shows that they don't really believe in their heart of hearts what they're saying.
Jason, you watched Expelled, I take it.
I did, yes.
There was one of the key scenes that just sticks in my mind. Professor Provine from Cornell University, he begins to get rather full of zeal and excitement when he says, there is no free will, there is no right and wrong, there is no morality, there is no meaning. I tell you, there is no meaning. If I get cancer, I'll blow my brains out. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. You remember that scene? Okay, now here's a man who's rather epistemologically self-conscious in some of these areas. What do you say to him? I mean, why is he still teaching science? I mean, that's the question that came back to mind. Did that question occur to you? Why is this man teaching science?
It always surprises me when people say that we don't have free will, and then they try to convince me of that fact as if I had free will.
Yeah, exactly.
As if I could rationally examine the evidence and choose the best.
Yeah, as if you could make the choice yourself.
Right? Yeah, and you know, when there's no moral standards anyway. So I guess what I would say to Will is, I'd say, well, I want to change your mind on that subject. And so what I'm going to do is hook electrodes up to your brain and send a few thousand volts through you until you change your mind.
Mm-hmm.
They said, well, you can't do that. Well, why can't I do that? You just told me there's no moral standards by which I shouldn't be able to do that. And you've told me there's no free will anyway, so your brain's just chemistry anyway. I figure if enough volts through you, you'll change your mind.
Yeah.
Now, see, in an evolutionary worldview, there's no reason why I couldn't do that. Now, of course, I wouldn't do that because I'm a Christian, and in the Christian worldview, I believe we do have freedom of choice, and we can make decisions based on the evidence and so on. But that's because I have a worldview that's consistent, one that makes sense of the evidence, because it's the worldview that God has, basically. It's the one that God has given us in His Word, revealed to us in His Word.
Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Jason Lyles, the author of a new book, Ultimate Truth of Creation, also Discerning Truth, some great new resources from Answers in Genesis. And when we get back, we're going to talk about logical fallacies. We're going to walk you through how to defend your faith and how to analyze arguments that unbelievers bring to you or evolutionists bring up in your college classrooms. Be back in just a moment. This is Kevin Swanson of the program, Generations. Folks, believe it or not, this is our eighth year on the air. Our first broadcast was October 3rd, 2003. From the beginning, we produced the program as a commercial endeavor, and then 2 years ago decided to rely entirely on listener support. And by God's grace, we're making some progress. But this is fundraising month. Each year, we target 100 sponsors to keep us on the air for one more year. And we're hoping that by God's grace, we will be on the air for one more year. If you find the ideas helpful on this program, if you receive some discipleship, some encouragement yourself, please consider supporting our program. We know that we have about 500,000 listeners a year from 80 countries around the world. We have people in Sweden, Ireland, Australia, England, many of whom have no other encouragement for the kind of ideas they get on this program. But they get it here on Generations. They're encouraged every day by what they hear on this radio broadcast from my basement out on the eastern plains of Colorado. So if you listen to the program or watch us, you know what we're all about. Family, fathers, freedom, faith, home-based discipleship, family-based economies, relationships in a cold and lonely world, worldview and discipleship, truth and relationships, a vision for future generations. That's what we're all about. And we are so privileged to get the very best speakers, pastors, fathers, Christian leaders in the country, talk about worldview and family issues. Folks like Mike Farris, Ken Ham, Vody Baucham, Al Mohler's been here, Paul David Tripp, R.C. Sproul, Phyllis Schlafly, David Noble, Tim Challies, Nancy Percy, Wayne Grudem, Sam Crabtree, and Dave. Dave Buhner, he's a regular on the program. Well, folks, we don't get a lot of psychobabble flim-flam on this program, because we don't want to raise up more wiki-wiki fruits for generations to come. Our desire is a vision that will cast for future generations and will encourage and inspire many generations and hopefully rebuild faith, family, and freedom during the breakdown of Western civilization. That's what we're doing out here in the Eastern Plains of Colorado. If you'd like to support the program, just simply go to our website, kevinswanson.com, and click on Support the Program and join our fundraising campaign. Our target is 100 sponsors. 100 sponsors at $10 a month, $20 a month, or $50 a month, or even a one-time donation. Friends, if you would like to support the program, kevinswanson.com. That's kevinswanson.com. Folks, back on the Generations Radio broadcast today, talking about the defense of the faith and analyzing the arguments that evolutionists present to you. With me, Dr. Jason Lyle from Answers in Genesis, author of the new book, Ultimate Proof of Creation. Also, another new book, Discerning Truth, and great resources for your homeschools or for preparation for your young people as they go out into the world and engage in the marketplace of ideas. Jason, I appreciate you being here with us today. Let's get back to the issue of defending the faith with the evolutionists. And you pull out a piece of evidence. You say, well, this does not appear to be proof for evolution. I'm not seeing the connection here. Then he comes back with what you call a rescuing device. Why don't you talk to that for just a moment? How is he going to come back?
Well, you know, it wouldn't matter what evidence you presented. For every evidence you can present, there's always a rescuing device. And I'll just give you a quick example from my own field of astronomy. There are comets that orbit around the sun, and as they orbit the sun, they lose mass because comets are made of ice, and the sun is hot, so it vaporizes that ice. That's what forms a comet's tail. It's material being blasted away. Now, we know how much material is available. We know how big the comet is, and we know the rate at which the material is being blasted away. It turns out comets can't last more than about 100,000 years maximum, but where they'd be gone.
Wow. Okay.
And that's perfectly consistent with a universe that's 6,000 years old,
sure.
around the age that the Bible tells us. But if the universe, if the solar system is 4.5 billion years old, as my secular colleagues believe, there shouldn't be any comets left. But there they are.
Wow.
Now, my secular colleagues are undaunted by this, though, because they're able to come up with a rescuing device. They're saying, no problem, there must be a generator that makes new comets, which we call the Oort cloud. Now, nobody's ever seen the Oort cloud, mind you, but it's supposedly a reservoir of, let's call them, potential comets out beyond the planets where we can't see it, and every now and then as one of them is thrown into the inner solar system, it becomes a brand new comet. And so he says, we see it's no problem, because as the old comets are destroyed, new ones replace them. Now, he's no evidence of an Oort cloud, but of course, if he's clever, he'll say, yeah, but you can't prove it's not there.
Yeah.
And that's true, I can't. And that's why if you just appeal to evidence just by itself, and I'm not saying you shouldn't appeal to evidence, I think you should, but if you just appeal to the evidence, it's never going to convince people. It's not going to convince a good, philosophically astute person, because he's always going to be able to come up with a rescuing device to explain that evidence in his own worldview. And by the way, Christians can do it too. Somebody asks you about an alleged contradiction in the Bible, some passage maybe that you're not all that familiar with. You don't immediately throw the Bible away. You say, well, I think there's some explanation for that. Give me time, I'll find it.
Yeah.
And so we all have our rescuing devices, which is why we need to get back to our worldviews and find out if our worldviews are rational. And then we can take a look at how our worldviews account for the evidence.
Sure. Well, let's talk about some of your logical fallacies that you address in your book, Ultimate Proof of Creation, and also Discerning Truth. You talk about reification, and this is something that occurs often in debates. What is reification?
Reification is where you attribute a concrete characteristic to something that's abstract. And in fact, sometimes you give it even personal traits. So, for example, the old expression, it's not nice to fool Mother Nature, is an example of reification, because nature is not something that can really be fooled, and certainly not a mother anyway. It's not something that has a mind. Now, reification in itself, there's nothing wrong with that in terms of literature. If you want to write a poem and have some reification in there, the Bible even uses reification in some of its poetic passages. Nothing wrong with that.
Right.
But when you use it as part of an argument, it can obscure important points, because it can, well, for example, if you say, how did life come about in such a way that it's fit for its environment? And say, well, you know, nature found a way. Nature selected.
Yeah.
Well, that's actually an example of reification, because nature doesn't have a mind that it can literally select in that way. I mean, we talk about natural selection, but technically that's a reification fallacy.
Right. It's not a real mechanism.
That's right. Somebody might say, well, science says this. Creationists say this, but science says that. Science doesn't say anything. Science is a set of tools that the Lord's given us, and it works very well under certain circumstances, but science doesn't say anything. Scientists say things.
It seems to me that people are very sloppy in their argumentation.
Oh, yeah. Especially when it comes to matters of origins. You'll find that there's a lot of, and I wish I could say it's all the evolutionists, but sometimes creationists make logical fallacies too. And that's why I really would encourage Christians to study up on logic and to know your logical fallacies, because they occur all the time.
As Christians look at the data around them, they're going to interpret that data as well. They'll look at billions of dead things laid down, rock layers laid down by water all over the earth, and they'll say, well, that was the flood that caused that. But then there's the other proposition, and that is that God said there was a worldwide flood where all flesh was destroyed from off the earth, and that was God's revelation. Now, we put one side by side with the other. On the one hand, we're interpreting data. We are interpreting data. We are, you know, proposition A is those dead things came from a worldwide flood 4,000 years ago. Proposition B is there was a worldwide flood 4,000 years ago. And I think the one proposition holds more weight than the other. Are you with me here? And I think Christians need to be at least honest with themselves about what they're doing.
And here's the thing, though. I mean, it's tempting to treat creation and evolution as just two competing models and see which fits the facts better. Yeah. And of course, you and I would look at it and we'd say, of course, the facts fit creation better. Sure, no problem there, because we have a correct worldview. Yeah. But my secular colleague, he's going to honestly look at that evidence and think that it better fits evolution. And he's going to say, oh, no, you're coming up with rescuing devices. And we're saying, no, you're the one that's coming up with the rescuing devices. Our interpretation of the evidence is natural. And so what we have to do is get back to our worldviews and find out which worldview is really right. And then we can tell you which one's making correct sense of the evidence. Now, I've got a worldview that's based on revelation from God, one that makes knowledge possible, one that can make sense of the fact that my senses are reliable, memory, laws of logic, laws of mathematics. The evolutionary worldview cannot make sense of those things, and yet evolutionists try to use those things when they do their arguments. And so their worldview is internally irrational, and therefore it cannot be the correct explanation of the scientific data, no matter how intuitive that may seem to them.
Hmm. And of course, our worldview is based on our assumption, our basic presuppositions, there is a God, and he's revealed himself to us by means of absolute truth, and that becomes the basis by which we can interpret, understand everything around us.
That's right. I think God's revelation to us, particularly in his word, needs to be our primary presupposition, and then the rest of them naturally fall into place.
What do you think the basic presupposition of the average scientist, evolutionist, atheist is out there? And what is his basic presupposition? My mind is God?
Yeah, that's a common one. That's a common one, that the mind is the ultimate truth, or empiricism, what I see, taste, touch, and smell, that's ultimately true.
But isn't that come back to your own mind, because your own mind interprets the data?
It sure does, yeah.
Right, so.
And, of course, empiricism is self-refuting, the idea that all truth claims are answered by observation. Now, of course, I think many truth claims are answered by observation. If I want to know what the weather's like outside, I go out and look. Nothing wrong with that. God made my senses, after all. But I don't believe all truth is answered that way. I couldn't know about life after death empirically, except after I died.
And it's hard to separate any one observation from your basic presupposition that you exist, God exists, and he's the ultimate existence anyway. So now we can start doing science.
Yeah.
So we can start observing things and drawing conclusions.
Yeah, and God, God wants us to observe things and draw conclusions, but he expects us to reason from the information that he's given us in his word.
Yes.
And not apart from it. So I think that's the real difference between the way I would do science and the way my secular colleagues would. They start from arbitrary presuppositions. I start from the revelation of God's word, interpret the data in accordance with that.
And speaking of arbitrariness, talk about equivocation in the arguments. I mean, there's such a problem with equivocation. How does your average Christian young person understand it and discern when that's happening?
Equivocation is where you switch the meaning of a word within an argument. Okay. Now, a lot of words have more than one meaning, and that's fine. But in a given context, a word means a given thing, and you're not allowed to switch that in the middle of an argument. And I'll give you an example of equivocation. Equivocation occurs very commonly with the word evolution. Mm. Evolution can mean just change. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, it can mean the idea that all life is descended from a common ancestor over billions of years. Mm-hmm. Now, I believe in the former type of evolution. I believe things changed. The Bible tells us the world was once a paradise. Today, it's not. Things changed. But I don't believe that all life is descended from a common ancestor. Okay, and so I believe in one type, but not another. Mm. Now, and that's fine, but if you switch those in the middle of an argument, then you got problems. And so an evolutionist might say, well, see, we know evolution's true because we see bacteria evolving into bacteria. You know, we see that they're evolving resistance to penicillin and such. Well, that's the type of change that I would believe in, but that doesn't prove the other type of change, does it?
Mm.
Or they might say, science is a very powerful tool, right? Yes.
Mm.
And evolution is science, so therefore evolution, you see, is a very powerful tool. Well, no, because they're equivocating on the word science, which can mean a set of tools that we use to understand the universe, or it can mean a specific scientific model, which we may or may not accept. And evolution, I don't think, is a particularly good one. And so they're equivocating on the word science.
Yeah, the micro to macro switch that people do all the time with evolution. I mean, they do it constantly with evolution. Isn't it somewhat like the parts to whole fallacy, where what's true of the parts, if there's a few little parts out here, something's true of this part, something's true of that part, therefore it must be true of the whole. Isn't that sort of what's happening as well?
Yeah, that's a fallacy composition. That's also a fairly common one.
Yeah. Isn't that what's going on here in the micro macro switch?
Well, it can be, but I would say that with the micro and macro, we actually would kind of stay away from those terms a little bit, because it's not so much the amount of change as it is the direction of the change.
I see, right.
And
right,
so I would say we don't believe in information increasing type improvements in organisms, but we do believe that organisms can change. They can change quite drastically.
What do evolutionists say when you start talking about information increasing? I mean, do they get nervous? Do they say, well, I've got another argument for that? How do they come back?
Most of them, honestly, have never thought about it. They've been trained to think in terms of mutations making something better or worse.
Yeah.
And we say, you know, I don't really care about that. There are mutations that make things better in the sense that they increase survival value under certain situations. That's fine. But they don't add brand new instructions to it. In order for evolution to be true, you'd have to add brand new instructions to the DNA. Because the fact is, a human being has more instructions in our DNA than bacteria. And so if we're evolved from something like a bacteria, a single-celled organism, then at some point you have to get new instructions in there. And we can't think of any way to do it. And nobody's been able to think of any way.
Jason, it seems to me these guys are intelligent people. Why don't they come back and say, oh, right, got me. I've got to go back and figure that one out. At this point, aren't they going to throw in a rescuing device of some sort?
Absolutely. And that rescuing device might be, give us time, we'll find it. We call it the eschatological cop-out.
Punctuated equilibrium, whatever that is.
Yeah.
It seems to be another rescuing device, isn't it?
Oh, it is. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, see, that's a great example of one, because mm-hmm. we don't find the continuum of transitional forms in the fossil record that evolutionists were expecting. And so they said, well, obviously, that's because evolution happened in such a way as to not leave those transitions. It doesn't occur to them that the model might be wrong.
Yeah.
They're thinking, well, you know, evolution must have happened in a herky-jerky fashion so that you know, lots of rapid spurts and then very little change. And so that's why you don't find a continuum of transitions in the fossil record. Instead, you find change within a kind.
At this point, doesn't anybody say, I think it may be that the emperor has no clothes or the guy behind the screen is just pulling my leg here? I'm being led to believe too much with too little evidence here.
Yeah, and there are people that see through that, and they're called creationists.
Yeah, exactly. Well, let me throw out something else here. Here's a common argument you hear from time to time. Hey, science has given us computers, medicine, the space program, so much more. Why do you guys keep denying the science of evolution? I mean, come on. I saw this in a YouTube video last week, Jason.
Yeah, that's a great example of an equivocation fallacy right there. They're confusing one type of science. The type that puts people on the moon is the type we do believe in, the type that comes from the Bible, by the way. And then the type of so-called science that you talk about millions of years ago, that's not something you can repeat or test in a laboratory. That's not something that that makes computers work and things like that. That's something totally different. That's a belief system about the past. And so they're really changing the meaning of the word in the middle of the argument, and that is an equivocation fallacy.
Do scientists, these evolutionary scientists, admit at all that there are distinctive forms of science? I mean, will they at least admit that much, that yes, there are different forms of science? I think you talk about predictable behavior in science. You talk about science based upon models, science based upon in certain forms of evidence and repetition and experimentation. So there's different forms of science. Will they at least acknowledge there are different forms of science and in any way calibrate their dogmatism as they bring out their conclusions?
You know, some of them do. Some of them do recognize that there are different types of science and that some are stronger than others. Others don't. And I find usually the people that actually do the science are the ones that recognize that there is a distinction. Those people that actually do observational science will recognize that there is a difference between what we can repeat in a laboratory and what allegedly happened a long time ago in the past. One can be confirmed, the other really can't be. I find the people that are reluctant to admit that are the diehard evolutionists that don't really do science in terms of a laboratory and things like that, but nonetheless believe in evolution.
Yeah.
They're the ones that are less inclined to acknowledge the distinction between operational and origin science.
Yeah. Okay, here's one more argument. See how you would handle it. Either the universe operates in a law-like fashion or God is constantly performing miracles. It's got to be one or the other. What is this?
That's a bifurcation fallacy.
Okay.
Another one of my favorites, because there could be a third alternative, and in many cases there are. Maybe the universe normally operates in a law-like fashion, I would argue, because God upholds it in a consistent way.
Yes.
And maybe God occasionally does something in an unusual way. He's God. He can do what he wants.
And that's what miracles are all about, I thought. I thought a miracle is something supernatural and would be an occasional sort of short-circuiting the normal operation.
Yeah, it wouldn't have to be, because God could do something extraordinary that's within what we call laws of nature, the parting of the Red Sea and whatever he uses wind to do it. Mm-hmm. But if God wants to suspend the law of nature, that's not a problem for him. He's God. Mm-hmm. He can do what he wants. And so it seems to me that science would not come to a crashing halt if there's occasionally a miracle. That's not a problem. And so the idea that it's either this or that, when in fact there's a third possibility, is called a bifurcation fallacy. It's another very common one.
Here's my favorite argument of all. Shut up, you little twerp. I have a PhD. That's the last one. That's the final argument. As you're sitting next to that, you know, the PhD in paleontology on a flight out of London, you know, at the point where you land in New York, that's pretty much the last argument, I think.
And you can say, well, I'm sorry, sir, but that's a faulty appeal to authority. That's also a fallacy.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'd be happy to evaluate your argument.
Maybe a little ad hominem in there too, you know, referring to me as a little twerp, a little ad hominem there. Yeah, and unfortunately, so many arguments were reduced to that. I was in a discussion. It wasn't hardly a discussion. It was an argument on Channel 12 here in Denver. What would have been 5-6 years ago with Bill Jack, paleontologist. But boy, I tell you, there was so much anger and cussing and yelling, and I couldn't get a word in edgewise. I mean, it was awful. I normally rational, human beings that get along actually very, very well and treat each other with respect. It seems like at points like this, everything comes off and the gloves come off. The respect is gone, and these guys just become, flushed with excitement and with this irrational form of emotion, and just it all comes apart in front of you. Have you seen that before?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We see that a lot. I mean, we get hate mail all the time at this ministry, and a lot of times it's very emotional. And when people are that way, well, they really aren't engaging in reason anymore. Mm-hmm. They're spouting off opinions. Now, if people want to engage in reason and logic, I'm happy to dialogue with them. But if they're just going to yell at me, well, I'm not interested in that. I mean, I don't need to be yelled at. And so if they want to engage in logic, if they want to talk logic, hey, I'm happy to dialogue with them.
Ladies and gentlemen, the book is Ultimate Proof of Creation. The author is Dr. Jason Lyle from Answers in Genesis, and I would recommend a read of this book. It is not a difficult read. It brings some rather difficult topics down to a pedestrian style, and you will definitely be encouraged and equipped by this book, Ultimate Proof of Creation. Dr. Lyle, thanks so much again for joining us in Generations. We appreciate you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
And ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to the Generations Radio broadcast. And remember, friends, we are winding up our 2-month fundraising campaign to keep this program on the air for the next year. If you'd like to participate and be one of those 100 sponsors of this radio program, let me encourage you to go to kevinswanson.com right now and sign up to support this ministry. And again, we're looking for 100 folks willing to give $10, $20, $50 per month or just a one-time donation to keep us on the air for one more year. And every year, by God's grace, we get enough support to keep us going. So we appreciate all of you who have contributed to our ministry over the years. You can interact with the program by emailing me directly at host@kevinswanson.com. You can support the program and hear the program anytime, anywhere in the world at kevinswanson.com. This is Kevin Swanson inviting you back again next time as we continue to lay down a vision for the next generation.